I'd like to start, if we could, by turning to Leviticus 23 for the sermon today. Leviticus chapter 23 is a section of scripture we in the Church of God turn to regularly. We have a very detailed list of the festivals and holy days of God, and so we find ourselves drawn there as we approach these festivals. We're not going to read all of the verses here, but starting in verse 9, it begins to describe what we call the wave sheaf offering. And it's from this event, the wave sheaf offering that occurs during the days of unleavened bread, that we begin our count towards Pentecost. And so it goes through the instructions on that, what was to be done with the wave sheaf. And then beginning in verse 15, it has instructions about the Feast of Pentecost itself, or the Feast of Weeks. And so it goes through all the details. It says in verse 16, to count 50 days from the day after the seventh Sabbath, and offering this new grain offering. Then it goes through and talks about several of the instructions for the offerings themselves. And we won't get into all those details. We'll touch a little bit on this tomorrow on Pentecost. But it talks about the two loaves that are offered, a special offering. And then in verse 18, the lambs and rams. And in verse 19, adding kids and a sin offering and male lambs and waving them before the Lord in verse 20. In verse 21, it says, you shall proclaim on the same day that is a holy convocation to you. You shall do no customary work on it. It shall be a statute forever in all your generations. And then at the end of this, in verse 22, it seems to change thought. And we're going to focus then on verse 22. It says, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field. When you reap, nor shall you gather any gleanings from your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor, for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. This verse seems perhaps out of place. And so we read through all these verses dealing with offerings that we wave before God and counting to the Feast of Pentecost. And this verse kind of comes out of nowhere. In the sharing thoughts last night, it addressed this a little bit. But actually, this concept of not wholly harvesting the land is very much related to Pentecost. And it ties directly to the harvest. And so what seems like perhaps a parenthetical thought at the end of all this that really doesn't fit is quite interestingly enough, very fitting. And it ties in to what we're going to talk about today. This idea of not reaping wholly the fields and leaving the gleanings for the poor, for the stranger, because a recognition of who God is, ties directly to our topic today. And we're going to go to a book today that really hinges on this verse and the application of this verse. And that book is the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is full of very interesting themes. Lots of unique history that's given in the book of Ruth. There's themes of redemption, love story, there's marriage, there's faithfulness, integrity, all with a tremendous amount of symbolism today for us. It's considered by many to be one of the most beautiful books in the Bible. And actually the Jews, by tradition, read the book of Ruth on Pentecost. That's the scroll that they would bring forth and read for Pentecost services, because as we'll see, the theme and the meaning of Pentecost comes out quite well in the book of Ruth. And really, the book of Ruth is one of my favorite books. There's so much there. And really, the underlying love story tends to come forefront of our mind. But if we take our time to go through it, we'll find it's a beautiful book with lots of meaning for us today. I had a conversation with somebody a while back, years ago really, and it prompted the study of the book of Ruth, because they said, what's the point of the book of Ruth? It doesn't seem like it means anything, and it's just kind of thrown in there. But as hopefully we'll see today, there's a lot we can draw out. So as we undertake going through the book of Ruth, before we do that, I'd like for us to take a second. Because what I'd like to do is draw out lessons today. But what I'm hoping is that we, as we go through the book, we can very deliberately put ourselves in the shoes of each of the characters that we're going to read about. And I say characters, but these are real people. These are real people, and we have an account of this portion of their life. And for us to make this more real, it really helps if we put ourselves in their shoes. How would we react in this situation that they're presented with? How would we feel? What would our course of action be? And then we can compare and contrast, well, is it the right reaction versus how they do? And so we're going to read through and spend most of our time in the book of Ruth. We'll turn to a couple other verses, but mainly I want to stay in Ruth. And we can take jot down some notes for some supporting scriptures, but I want to stay in Ruth so that we can not burst that bubble, so to speak. So that we keep our minds focused in the story flow. And as we add details, hopefully it adds to the vivid color of this book. Because really, as we begin to paint this mental picture, it really lets this book come to life. And it can be quite emotional when we begin to do that. So I hope we'll begin to see this book is relevant for us. And if you're looking for a title, the title for the sermon today is simply, Lessons from the Book of Ruth, Part 1. Because there's so much, we're going to have to break this into two parts, and even then it'll be tight. But I think it's worth it. So let's turn, if you have not already, to the Book of Ruth. Joshua, Judges, Ruth. And we'll begin at the very beginning. In chapter 1 and verse 1. It says, Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his children were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephratites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went into the country of Moab and remained there. So here at the beginning of the book of Ruth, we're introduced to the first cast of characters. We have the father of a family. His name is Elimelech. Now, interesting note, Elimelech means God is my king. God is my king. We also have his wife, Naomi. Now, Naomi's name means pleasant. Quite the nice name. And as we'll see, the names are going to come into play as we read this story. So we have Elimelech, meaning God is my king. We have Naomi, which means pleasant, a beautiful name. Then we have their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Now, Mahlon's name means sickly. And Chilion's name means wasting away. If you're in the market for baby names, sickly and wasting away are on the table at this point. But that actually will play come into play as we begin to read the story. I wouldn't recommend naming your kids that, but if you really want to, go for it. But we are told the names of the beginning of our cast of characters, and these are real people who lived. Not only are we told their names and that they're a family, their family relation, we're given very important information about the setting of the story. The setting of this account of the family of Elimelech, we see the where. We find there a family who lived in the town of Bethlehem, which is in Judah, which also happens to be the birthplace both of, down the line, Jesus Christ and David. So a very important city. And Bethlehem as a city means house of bread. House of bread. We have the location. That's where it starts. It quickly moves from that location, but we'll get to that in a second. We are also told the time frame. We are told that this is in the period of the judges. The period before they had Saul come as king, but after they had entered into the promised land under Joshua, where the judges ruled the people. Now that may seem like a passing comment about the time, and certainly it does give us an indication of where they fall, and as we get to the end of the book, it'll give us more indication about the time, what year and so forth. But it gives us a better insight into the cultural background, societal background. If we were to go to the book of Judges, which spans a great deal of time from beginning to end, we would get a picture of what life was like, what the culture was like in Israel at this time, in Israel and Judah, but had not split yet. And the picture that's painted is quite grim. We see graphic accounts in the book of Judges. Graphic accounts of Israel, the chosen nation of God, rebelling against God time and time again. In fact, perhaps the best known phrase that describes this period of time is at the end of the book of Judges, in Judges 21, where it says, "Each man, there was no king in those days, but each man did what was right in his own eyes." That was the time period of the judges. And as a result of each person doing what was right in their own eyes, there was constant rebellion against the laws of God. And the accounts that are depicted there are graphic of a society that was contrary to God, who sinned against God continually. And what God enacted, where the people would sin great sins, and as a result, they would go into slavery, be punished. The surrounding nations would come in, and God would use them to correct His people. And the punishment of the people would get so great that they would come to God in supplication, asking for deliverance. God in His mercy and His covenant loyalty would offer to them salvation, deliverance by the hand of a judge, usually. And so what we find in the cultural background is that they were living in a time and a place that was not peaceful, that was not friendly to those who kept God's law. In fact, it was contrary to God's way of life. And there's perhaps a little bit of insight into one other tidbit that we mentioned, is that there was a famine in the land. There's a famine in the land of Judah. Now, interesting enough, it doesn't state the cause. We're told that it's the time of the judges. But the word famine is something stronger than just a drought. A drought occurs, you know, over the course of a year or 2 years, and you get dry. But famine is something serious. Very serious. And this indicates that there were severe conditions in the land. Severe enough that Elimelech chose to leave his hometown of Bethlehem, leave his family, leave his land, and sojourn to Moab. Now this is quite a large thing, because the family wealth was tied directly to the land. And he was leaving his family inheritance to go seek shelter in the neighboring country of Moab. Now it begs the question of why there was a famine in the land. We won't turn to the verses because we don't know for sure. It doesn't say the famine was because of the sins of the people. But one thing we do know in reading places like Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, the blessings and cursings, God promised that if the people followed Him, they wouldn't have famines. God would give them rain in due season. God would give them food to eat. And yet we find there is a famine in the land of Bethlehem at this time. So we know no matter how or why the famine is here, we see that there's the direst of situations, both physically in terms of the availability to survive, the livelihood, but also culturally, societally, the background is quite bleak as well. It doesn't say how long the famine was there before they fled, but they left and sojourned. And we'll find here in the next couple of verses that they left their homeland for 10 years. That's quite a long period of time. Let's continue on the story with that background. If we put ourselves again in their shoes, a severe famine forcing them to leave their inheritance, leave their families, leave their hometown, and sojourn to a foreign country. And so in verse 3, it says, Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. She was left and her two sons. Find right off the bat, they come in, it seems to indicate fairly quickly after they moved, it doesn't say exactly how long, but they moved to Moab and Elimelech dies. And Naomi's left as a widow, with two sons. Continue on in verse 4. Now these two sons took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, the name of the other was Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the children survived her two sons and her husband. So they go seeking refuge from this famine, seeking something, some sort of respite from the tragic situation there in Bethlehem. And instead, their trials seem to compound. Elimelech, the father of the family, the head of the household, dies. Naomi is left with two sons who marry Moabite women. We'll know later on that Chilion marries the Moab Orpah. I look at Orpah, I have to be very careful because I want to say Oprah when I read that. But it's Orpah. You've got to switch those P and R. Chilion marries Orpah, and Mahlon marries Ruth. We'll find that later on. But it says they both marry. Now, it's interesting to note there's no prohibition against marrying Moabitess women, as there's a family connection all the way back to Lot. The Moabites are descendant from Lot. We have that account there of what happened with Lot and his daughters. But the prohibition against marriage was to the four nations was Canaanite women, so that they didn't turn your hearts. So there is a prohibition, though, against the Moabites, specifically involving the children from such a marriage. That children that result from a marriage of an Israelite to a Moabite would to be cut off from the house of God for a number of generations. And we'll talk about that as we get into chapter 3 and 4. But we find after the marriage of the two sons, the father had died, both Chilion and Mahlon die as well, perhaps living up to their names, sickly and wasting away. They wasted away. The sickness caught up with them. And so our cast of characters dwindles. Elimelech's gone. Chilion's gone. Mahlon's gone. Leaving behind three widows without any children amongst them. So let's recap after five verses here. We have one severe famine, three dead husbands, two dead sons, three childless widows. On top of that, we're in a time period that's known for being spiritually bankrupt and against God's way of life, morally corrupt, a famine in your homeland. So much for the beautiful love story that we're supposed to have with Ruth. It's a tragic start to the book. And the book of Ruth indicates the perilous times that these three ladies are left in. To be a widow, a childless widow in this time would have been incredibly difficult. Not to mention that Naomi was in a foreign land. Not even the land of her home. Now we could take a second here, as we're only five verses in, and we're getting this mental picture, hopefully painted, of a family that's being torn apart, destroyed with trials and tribulations. And yet, even though this happened thousands of years ago, we can relate to this, can't we? We can relate to what's going on in this family. Different names, different trials perhaps, but the same suffering, the same tribulation. It may happen in a different way, but we can empathize going through tremendously difficult times. You know, we need to look no further than our prayer list each and every week. The prayer list for the little boy with the blood platelet disease. How heartbreaking is that to hear? And you think about the family. The prayer requests that have come out specifically for the young little kid, Samuel Edge, the little boy who was having those seizures in Australia. Thousands of seizures he had in the course of a week. Having to relearn how to eat and drink and talk. He was only 2 years old. We get children who are born with spina bifida. I think of Owen Zollner from Indiana, or Faith Hazelton in Missouri, who have tremendous struggles ahead of them. Samara Brock and the prayer requests that come out. Olivia Grider, the young little girl who was diagnosed with cancer, and then years later was in remission and then was diagnosed again with cancer. Those things tear us apart. And those are examples perhaps outside of us, but we have that going in our own families as well. Our own personal lives, struggles that we have that seem insurmountable. And doesn't it always seem to happen that we're going through a trial, and rather than come out of that trial and have ease of our pain and suffering, it compounds. You know, the death that we experience in our family compounded by other trials. Sickness of ourselves. Sickness of our loved one. Small things that build up. Our car breaks down. That seems, what perfect timing. Just like what's going on with the family of Naomi. One thing after another. A famine. Death of a husband. Death of the children. One thing after another. Not to mention the fact that we can look around the world today. We're not blind, and we see the moral bankruptcy that's continually to decline as people move further and further away from God, as mentioned in the sermonette. And that can bring us down as well. We see a society that perhaps mirrors that of the time of the judges. Everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. And yes, tragedy can strike us. The world around us will constantly be trying to pull us away from God. That's nothing new. It will get stronger and stronger, certainly. And at the core of all of this, though, there's a choice. This cast of characters is presented a choice with how they're going to respond. How are they going to react in the midst of this tremendous suffering? We're going to get an account of how they reacted. What did they do with what they were given? And it's no different for us. The trials that we go through, no matter how bad things get, we're always left with a choice. How will we react? How will we respond? That choice is never taken away from us. Brethren, I hope that as we're beginning this book, we relate to these people. That we see, we can put ourselves in their shoes and realize suffering that they're experiencing, we can empathize with. And we're going to get some accounts of how they live their life in response to that. What do they do with it? And we can ask ourselves the same question. What do we do when we're faced with tremendous trials? And we'll see, well, we won't spoil it. We've all read the book of Ruth, but as it plays out, it really unfolds quite beautifully. So let's continue on with the story. In verse 6, it says, "Then she," speaking of Naomi, "arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and giving them bread." So here we have this scenario where Naomi gets word that the famine has ended. Bethlehem, which, as we mentioned, means house of bread, that ceased to be the house of bread for about 10 years, was now once again the house of bread. And it's interesting to notice, as the Lord had visited his people, God had brought about a change in their homeland, at least the homeland of Naomi. God had blessed Judah with an end to the famine. And so Naomi decides to head back with, as we'll see here, with her daughters-in-law to go to where she's from, where her family is, and perhaps find a better life for themselves. So she hears about the land of Bethlehem, and they decide to go back. In verse 7, continuing on, it says, "Now therefore, she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her." They all left together. "And they went out on the way to return to the land of Judah." They began walking down the road together. All three of them, these three ladies who have been through so much, began heading back to Judah, specifically the city of Bethlehem. We're not told how long these three were on the journey. They all did leave together, and they're walking down the road. Some say that they went a short distance, just perhaps, you know, just down the road. Some say they made it all the way to the border of Israel. But we're not told. We're not told how long they're traveling. However long it was, something happens in verse 8. They're walking along, and Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." Naomi turns to her daughters-in-law, tells them they should go back to their families. She pronounces a blessing on them, saying, "You know, may God dwell kindly with you, because you were kind to me, and you were kind to my sons." And she wants them to go back to their families. We find in verse 9, "The Lord grant you that you may find rest." The reason she wants them to go back is she wants them to find rest. You know, this theme of rest is going to come to play prominently in chapter 2 and 3 and 4. But we will talk about that later. That's a better time to address what this means. What does it mean to rest? What does it mean to have rest? But that's what Naomi desires for these two daughters-in-law. She says, find rest, each in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." So she tells them to go back. They kiss, and they lament and cry, because both daughters-in-law love Naomi. And they respond by saying, "No, we're not going to leave you. We're going to come with you. We're going to continue to accompany you all the way back to your people." they're going to return with her. Obviously, they have a deep emotional connection. The relationship that was made between them is strong. In verse 11, Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters." Again, she's reiterating, "Why will you go with me?" You know, initially she was describing the interest that she has for their well-being. But here she gets to the heart and core of why she wants them to go back. She says, "Will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have a hope, even if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." That's quite the telling pronouncement that she makes here for several reasons. She's making a case for why they should go back. And she's telling them, "I have nothing left to offer you." We're getting a glimpse of a woman, Naomi here, who is at her weakest, rock bottom. And she's telling the only support that she has left, these two daughters-in-law, "Go back. I have nothing left to offer you." She refers here to birthing more husbands for them. Well, we won't turn there, but Deuteronomy 25 discusses what's called the Levirate marriage law, where if a son dies, the brother of that son would rise up and marry the widow so that they could have children and the inheritance would be passed along. And so Naomi is saying, "Look, I'm so old that even if I had a chance of getting married, if I found a guy tonight, and even if I found a guy tonight, and I had kids, would you wait for them to be grown for them to be your husbands? There's no hope." She's describing her hopelessness. There would be no husbands that she could provide. There would be no inheritance waiting for them back in Bethlehem. There was nothing. And so we find a double-edged sword, because despite any personal benefit Naomi would have, she unselfishly releases both of these ladies from any obligation that they felt they had to her. They had a very close relationship, and she's saying, "Look, I understand, but there's nothing I can offer you, and I want what's best for you." It's pretty profound. Not only that, there's a phrase at the end that's very telling. At the end of that, she says, she attributes the troubles and trials that she's going through. She says, "It grieves me very much for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." She felt as if God himself was out to get her, had gone out against her. Now, this is not uncommon. We could think back to the book of Job and his sentiments that are expressed when he was at his worst. And that appears to be where Naomi's at. But it's important to take stock of where she's at mentally, emotionally, and again, put ourselves in her shoes. In the midst of all that, rock bottom, she still wants what's best for Orpah and Ruth. She tells these to the two ladies, and we find their responses in verse 14. "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." So here, after that last urging or pleading for them to leave, Orpah kisses her, but Ruth is still quite devoted, and it's describing her as clinging to her. So Naomi essentially convinces Orpah. And so Orpah kisses her, and she heads back to her family. But Ruth, in a very devoted fashion, clings to her mother-in-law, unwilling to let go of a hug. And it says, it continue on in verse 15, Naomi's not done. She says, and she said, "Look," speaking to Ruth, "your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." We're beginning to get more insight into what it meant for Orpah and Ruth to leave Naomi. Orpah leaves, returning not only to her family, but also to her gods, foreign gods, false gods. The implication is that both wives had left their pagan religion when they married Mahlon and Chilion. This was a common practice in the day, as the women would be subject to the religion of their husband. That was the most common thing. That was the standard back then for wives. But it does show an interesting difference between Orpah and Ruth. Because Orpah had made a commitment to Naomi, but apparently not a long-lasting commitment to the true God. Because she forsakes that, forsakes God to go back to the pagan gods. But Ruth does not. She clings to Naomi. And here, even after this third urging, we'll see refuses to leave. And in her response, we get a really beautiful sentiment described, but we'll get insight into Ruth's mind. Her devotion not only to Naomi, but also to God. And it's one of the most beautiful sections in Scripture. So we have Naomi again urging Ruth to go for this third time. And Ruth, finally, we have recorded her words, what she says in response. In verse 16, Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. When you die, or where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." You can see this playing out. A hopeless woman having a companion that's willing to stick by her. In unfettered devotion. And in one of the most beautiful and endearing passages in Scripture, Ruth commits herself to Naomi. But more than that, commits herself to God. It's certainly, there are two aspects to this. Because we have a commendation, certainly, of the character of Naomi. In order to receive such devotion, what manner of woman would she had to have been for someone to look up to her in such a way that they would literally commit your life and in a vow to God say, "If you know, the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts us." That's the level of devotion Ruth had to Naomi. And so we read in reading, and it took 20 seconds, 30 seconds, if you read through it slowly. In that 20 to 30 seconds, she's making a lifelong promise to follow Naomi, but follow Naomi's God and Naomi's people. So we have this dual thing taking place. She's committing herself to follow Naomi, follow God, follow, be with Naomi's people, to become one of them. But it also means a forsaking of everything she's leaving behind permanently. She's not leaving herself any refuge to go back to the home families in Moab, to go back to the pagan gods. She's committing herself on the line, 100%, and makes an oath. It's not a light oath at all. As we were going through and talking about this, what comes to mind? For me, amplified even more so because of what we did this morning with Brianna. Does this not make us reflect back to our baptismal commitment? It does me. When we read through this commitment, are we not reminded of the commitment each and every one of us made at baptism? However long ago that was. 1 year, 2 years, or in the case of Brianna, 5 hours ago. That's the commitment we made. And it's the same way that Ruth had a dual fold, both aspects in committing to God, but also forsaking everything else. That's the same for us. We made a lifelong commitment to follow God 100%. Verse that comes to mind is Luke chapter 9. And I don't know if we have time to go there, because I'm already looking at the clock and we're already running behind. But Luke chapter 9 is beautiful because it talks about the commitment. And Christ had these people coming up to him and saying, "You know, I want to follow you, but I want to go bury my father first. I want to go follow you, but I want to do X, Y, and Z." And in each case, Christ rebukes them and says, "That's not how it works. If you're with me, you're with me. You forsake everything else." And then it ends with verse 62, which says, "He who, having set his hand to the plow, looking back, is not fit for the kingdom of God." That's the commitment we have made. 100% devotion, just like Ruth. Not a matter of keeping our options open in case something better pops up over the fence and we can head over there. Or we'll follow God as long as it makes sense for me, or as long as things are good. There's a simplicity in that. And I'm reminded back of even this morning reading the baptism ceremony. It's very short. It takes about a minute to go through. And yet, the commitment that's made in that is profound. We can see an analogy here, a parallel that we can tie into. But it's also interesting because as we start to delve into this, we see the commitment is to God. Yes. She says, your God will be my God. But it's also to Naomi and her people. She's recognized she's got a new family. Her family she left in Moab is not her family anymore. Her family is now obviously they are her family physically, but she says, your people are my people now. Just as my people were my people, your people are my people. And that's a direct parallel to us as well. In the same way that we make a commitment of baptism to God, we're also telling God that we're joining a bigger family. We are saying that we will commit to God, but we're also committing to His people. We're supplied entrance into a spiritual body, a spiritual family. Which means, yes, we're not going it alone. We have the support of one another. We have that. But also, we have to be there for one another. Because we are each other's people. We're called to be each other's people. Help one another through trials. Help one another overcome. Encourage, uplift, edify, exhort. That's our responsibility to each other. And in the same way Ruth said the commitment was unto death, is the same commitment we have towards each other. And so we can ask ourselves this question. Really, if we see the profound nature of the commitment that's made, ask ourselves the question, between just us as a group, do we have that same commitment towards one another that Ruth showed towards Naomi? The idea was such that the bond between Ruth that was so great that she refused to leave, even in the face of hardship, up to and including her very death. Now, I say that we fall short in that because we're human. And I know that most of you would agree, and hopefully all of us would agree, that we fall short. We're imperfect in this. But I think we could use more of this in our lives. We could use more of this in the church of God. This attitude, this approach. Because I'm reminded, we think of this commitment. If anything but death parts us. And we can think back in our history within the church of God, however long that would be, and see perhaps how petty the things we allow to separate us are. How easily we separate ourselves from one another. The smallest things you can think of, we allow to divide us. And when we do, we fail to have this attitude. If anything but death part us. So I hope we see the commitment Ruth is making. These two verses we could do a sermon on by itself because it's so impressive and monumental. And so when we read this commitment, I hope we think of our commitments that we have made to God and to His people. And I hope that our commitment to that is stronger today than when we first made it. And not to, just because it came to mind, Hebrews 11 comes to mind. The faith chapter. That says, if they had called to remembrance, they could have gone back to those people who were faithful. They could have gone back to their home countries, but they didn't. They looked for a city whose builder and maker is God. The other side of the coin, briefly touch, is Naomi. Because we can learn from her example as well. The example that she must have set that drew Ruth in, that was not drawing necessarily completely only into her, but also to God. They were one and the same. And so when Ruth makes a commitment to Naomi, she recognizes the commitment also to God and His people. And that should be us as well. That when people see us, that they see God as well. I have a verse, Zechariah 8, 23. We won't turn there, but it's a millennial scripture talking about, 10 people will grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man and say, take us with you because we've heard God is with you. That's our responsibility, is to shine as light so that people may be drawn to us, but more so drawn to God because they see something different in what God is working in our lives. And we don't have time to delve into that, but there's lots of implications because it's easier to blend in than to stand out. And we don't have that same example that we can set. So Naomi's example is powerful as well, of one who is different in a good way. So much so that she led Ruth to God. Let's continue on before we run out of time or eat into men's and ladies' club. In verse 18, we get Naomi's response. Now when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. There's no point. I'm not going to convince her. So she stops. Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem, and as it happened, as they came to Bethlehem, that all the city was excited because of them. Here we have 10 years that passed, but Naomi's coming back, and the whole city's in an uproar. They're excited because of the women. And the women said, is this Naomi? Is this Naomi that we knew from 10 years ago? And Naomi responds by saying, she said to them, do not call me Naomi. Now remember, her name meant pleasant. She says, no longer do I want you to call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Literally, Mara means bitter. And so distraught was she over what she went through, she wants to change her name. I don't want to be pleasant anymore because it doesn't reflect my situation. Call me Mara. Call me Mara. She says, continuing on, I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. You know, it's interesting, she's attributing all this to God. But when we go back and read why they left Bethlehem, it was from a famine. And yet, perhaps she has a distorted view of the past. She said, I went out full. Well, how do you mesh that? You're in the midst of the famine and you had to leave your inheritance because the famine was so bad. And when you're saying you went out full, perhaps from her perspective, just having family. But she's saying, I went out full and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi or pleasant, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? So Naomi returned and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So, just to briefly sum up this and not get into it in great detail, but we get insight into Naomi's thinking, where she's at as we end chapter 1. We find that she's telling everybody to call her this different name. She's so distraught over what she's been. And she's saying, God is testifying against her. God is afflicting me. God is bringing this about. Again, very reminiscent of Job. So that's important to get her insight into her mind. But at the very end, there's a phrase. And it says, they came back to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So we had talked about the timeline we have with the judges, the time period as far as the years. But this one phrase gives us insight into the time of year. It says, at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now we could go back and read in Leviticus 23, those verses that we've mentioned. But the barley harvest could not start until the wave sheaf was offered, which occurred during the days of unleavened bread. And so it gives us time line of when they would have come back home. They would have come back to Bethlehem just after Passover. Passover would have at least have, they could have been perhaps in the midst of the days of the bread, but it would have been after Passover. So the spring of the year, which will come into play because begins the count of Pentecost, we'll see that the events of the harvest that are going to take place are actually moving towards Pentecost. But we find they come back from all of this just after the time of Passover. So let's continue on to chapter 2. Excuse me. It says in chapter 2 in verse 1, and Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, please let me go to the field, glean heads of grain from him in whose sight I may find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. Now remember, we went to Leviticus 23 and read in verse 22 that the people were not to harvest all of the fields, nor to collect all the gleanings, yet they're to leave it for the poor. Naomi and Ruth would have certainly fell into that category. They would have been incredibly poor. No husbands, no children, no inheritance, no land. And for those who were poor, the only opportunity they would have in surviving would be out of the kindness of others. Specifically, in this case, those who would be obeying God's laws. To not harvest the entirety of the field, but allow for gleanings to be taken for those who were poor. And so Ruth says, let me go to the field and glean heads of grain on him whose favor, or on whose sight I may find favor. She wants to find somebody who will look kindly on her and allow her to glean. And at verse 1, we're introduced to the final main character, and that is Boaz, which will come to play as we continue reading. But Ruth decides to go out and glean what we read about in Leviticus, and she makes a comment that she wants to find favor in someone's sight. And so she goes. In verse, Naomi tells her to go, my daughter. In verse 3, she leaves. Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was in the family of Elimelech. Now it's interesting because when we look into what this word happened to come about. I liked what was said in the sermonette. Things that happened to take place. That's basically what's being described here. As we read through this account, what happened to take place is really indicating God's hand. This doesn't mean that it's happenstance or luck. It's describing divinely inspired events. God's hand was guiding this. And so she happened. God led her in some way, or allowed this to come to play, that she gleaned in the field of Boaz. Now we'll find that Ruth, in most of this account, seems to be naive about this. She's not doing this with intent or purposely. But she makes her way, it happens, into Boaz's field. And she begins to glean there. In verse 4, it says, now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And answered him. They answered, that being his workers, the Lord bless you. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? Referring to Ruth, asking about the lady who was gleaning. So the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, it is a young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. So Boaz comes and finds Ruth gleaning in the field. And interestingly to note, we don't have time to go into this a lot, but the greetings between Boaz and his workers really signifies the relationship that Boaz had with his workers, where they greet him by saying, the Lord bless you. We begin to get a picture painted of a man who was godly. Even in his dealings with his servants, he was godly. He had relationship with them that was strong. And he asks about this young woman, and the servant gives an accurate account, a detailed account. The story of what took place, who this was. We read earlier that there was quite a bit of commotion when they came into town. And so he knew this is Ruth, the Moabite woman who came. But gives a good account of Ruth, noting her work ethic. She's worked all morning. Said she did rest a little bit in the house, but she's been working hard. She was there to work. She wasn't there expecting a handout from Boaz, but she went right to work, and hard work. And we'll find that the account of her work ethic impressed Boaz. It made an impression. Beyond that, Ruth had a good name for herself. So we'll continue on. Again, there's a lot that we could say about this, but it's worth further study. I'll just say that. And go back and delve into this a little deeper. So he gives this good account of her. And verse 8 says, then Boaz said to Ruth, you will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. So Boaz approaches Ruth. You know, this is really where the love story begins to take off. The meeting of Boaz and Ruth. Now, as we get into chapter 3, we'll get to understand the deeper motivation and the deeper feelings they have for each other. But Boaz here deals very kindly with Ruth. He tells her, don't go anywhere else to glean. He wants her to be in the safety of his field, among his young women, where he can watch over her. And he's commanded all the young men not to touch her, to leave her alone. More than that, he says, you can drink from my water that's already been pulled. Rather than having to pull from the well her own to drink, so drink from the vessels that my young men have already pulled. And so he shows her protection, which certainly could be a concern, as we had talked about this time period set in the time of Judges, and offers water. It says, drink from this water that's already been pulled. Protection and respite. Comfort. As we go through this, we'll see Boaz really as a type of Christ. And we reflect to John 7, where Christ says, come to me and I'll give you living waters. You'll never thirst. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me. Which again ties very directly to Pentecost and the meaning with that. And so Boaz here is symbolic of that. And so we have this kindness expressed by Boaz, and then in verse 10 we get Ruth's response. It says, then she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? Not only was it a kindness, it was even more so a kindness because she was a foreigner. She had no rights in that sense in most people's eyes. There's no reason for him to be kind to her. He could have just tossed her aside, kicked her out. Let the people of Israel glean if they want to glean. I don't need you here causing problems. She's flabbergasted. She asks, what have I done to deserve this favor? I can't help but read this and think back into my own calling. And hopefully we can think of our calling as well. Those moments when we realize and stand in awe of that calling. And as David said, you know, what is man that you're mindful of him? We come before God and say, what have we done to deserve your love, your mercy, your kindness, your comfort? And we bow down before God in prayer and ask that. Because we've done nothing. We're just specks of dust. And I hope we have that same attitude that Ruth does when we come before God. Ask, why us? Why me? Thank you. But why me? And perhaps we've had those feelings of just being overwhelmed. But also recognizing that our gifts come from God. There's lots of parallels we can draw here. Continuing on, Boaz responds, and he says to her, it has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how your mother and the land of your birth, since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. Then she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not one of your maidservants. A beautiful interaction. And Boaz here is offering the kindness that he can because he recognizes Ruth's character. It's been reported to me how you dealt with Naomi. You are a woman of character. And he was so impressed by this that he felt a personal obligation to help her, to look after her. Notice the way he describes it is the Lord repay you. The Lord is giving you shelter. It seems as if he saw himself as being used by God in this way. That God had blessed him with much and he was going to use that to bless her because she was deserving of a blessing because of the way she responded to Naomi. The way that she acted, the way that she carried herself. And we find Ruth again is flabbergasted, in awe of this, thanking, you're treating me like a maidservant, and I'm not. And so she ends by saying, I found favor. Let me find favor. You've dealt comfort, spoke kindly to me and comforted me. Here in the midst of being bewildered, not knowing where you're going to find your next meal, a man comes and begins to provide comfort and protect her. And it all, as it goes back in verse 3, because she just happened to come into his field. Let's go continue in verse 14. Boaz said to her at mealtime. So they're all working in the field, and it comes to mealtime. She says, come here and eat of the bread, and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her parched grain to her, and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back. Not only is he showing her kindness by drawing water for her and letting her clean and giving her protection, he says, come have a meal with me. Have some bread. Dip it in this vinegar, which would have been above and beyond just a normal meal of just bread, but a special treat. And we find that she eats and she's filled, but she keeps a little back. This will come, we'll see what she does with this later. Actually, it makes me think of Ghana. When I went to Ghana in 2009, we sat down with the campers in the first meal. I remember there were 100 campers. And we ate our meal, and I was watching the kids eat. And the kids would eat, and then I saw them grabbing the food and putting it in their pockets. They're all putting it in their pockets. And I turned to, I can't remember who it was, one of the staff members, and I said, why are they putting all their food in their pockets? And I said, for them, this is a feast. They don't know where they're going to get another meal. And so they're saving it for later. And that's kind of, I get this picture of Ruth, who is really poor, impoverished. And so she's eating to her full, and she keeps a little back. We'll find out what she does with that later, but it's almost like a something you have in your brain to, when you have, make sure you take all that you can, because you don't know when you're going to get again. We'll find out it's not selfish. I'll say that. So, continuing on. She eats a meal with them. In verse 15, she rose up to glean. Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves. Do not reproach her. Now, what would happen is that men would bundle the sheaves, and then there would be perhaps some droppings of grains from there. But he's saying, let her even go in among there. Be sloppy with your work. Continuing on, he says, also let some of the grain from your bundles fall purposely for her. Leave it that she may glean and not rebuke her. Now, if you've ever been a manager of some sort, you want your employees to be diligent, especially when it comes to finances and account for all of the goods. Boaz here says, guys, today we're going to be bad workers. Kick some of the grain off. Don't do the best job. Don't pick up every little piece. In fact, whole bundles drop and let her have. Don't pick it up. Don't rebuke her. Let her take not just the gleanings, but from the actual harvest. What is the beautiful thing in this, because he's showing tremendous kindness this whole time, he adds on to this by giving her even more. And Ruth was not only going to get leftovers, she's getting full bundles. Nelson's Study Bible says this about the kindness that Boaz shows. It says, he exhibited the highest form of charity by giving in secret so as to not shame the recipient. Ruth had no idea. We'll see that later. She's gleaning and gleaning, and he's doing a bad job actually giving it to her, basically, letting it fall at her feet, and she's working as hard as she can. She's going back and gleaning and gathering all this, and he, in his kindness, doesn't embarrass her. She still has to work for it. But he's giving to her in abundance. As we go to verse 17, she gleaned in the field till evening, beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She goes through and she gets all the harvest. She gets the final count of the grain as an ephah. Now, an ephah of grain measures out to about 31 pounds. That's a lot of barley that she gleaned in just this one day. That's a good haul. Now, she doesn't see anything, as we will see, she doesn't see anything unusual about this. She beats out the grain, and she's going to take it back home. But if we want to stop and just remember how this story started. Remember even how chapters 2 started. The tremendous trial and stress that this family was under. Naomi and Ruth, destitute. They were poor, had no hope in their lives. Ruth has now garnered favor with a godly man who is caring for her in an outstanding way. He's providing for her food, protecting her. Not only that, unbeknownst to Ruth, this man is a near kinsman, which will come into play, from the family of Elimelech. Things are actually looking up. A blessing and a bountiful day. And Ruth doesn't even realize it yet. You know, this serves as a reminder for us. It ties together well with the sermonette, because when we're in the midst of the trials, it's hard to see the end result, to see the light at the end of the tunnel, to think God is not even looking at us. He can't hear us. We're crying up to Him. It's hard for us to see the end of our trials, the end of our suffering. And yet, again, we have a choice in how we will respond. Will we allow ourselves to get discouraged, even unto depression, to sink deeper and deeper into that? Or will we look to God and remember God cares for us? God wants what's best for us. You know, that's one of the most powerful things we have in the midst of trial, is to latch onto the character of God, the promises of God. That will help us get through that. Physically, we may be suffering, but mentally, emotionally, spiritually, we can be strong if we choose to rely on God. Remember these things. And so we don't have time to go all through this, but we have a wonderful example of Boaz. Someone who is blessed by God, but in turn then takes that and gives bountifully to those in need. We ought to be giving, a lesson we can draw from Boaz. Do we share in the blessings that God has given to us? Hopefully we do. Let's continue on. We got to get to the end of the chapter before we call it quits for the sermon today, part one. And so we had this wonderful blessing that took place in verse 18. She took it up and went to the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. And so she brought it out and gave it to her. She gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied. So she comes and meets Naomi. She has this huge sack of 31 pounds of barley that she's carrying with her. But remember how she had held back a little bit of that special meal? She had held it back not for herself, but to give to Naomi. And so she pulls that out and she shares with Naomi. I think that's a beautiful picture right there. She didn't keep it for herself to have later, but she wanted to share of that special bread that she had received, share it with Naomi. I think that's just a small little token of a couple of people, a mother and daughter-in-law who have nothing and yet share in everything. That's family. That's what family does. That's a beautiful sentiment to me. But she comes back and she shares what she had received from the day with her mother-in-law. And verse 19, we get Naomi's response. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where have you gleaned today?" This is something that's a little bit strange, Ruth. Where have you been? Where did you glean that you get all of this? And where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you. She recognized right off that this was not something that happened in everyday life. She realized that somebody had took notice of her and had done a kindness to her by giving her all of this. Naomi is quite wise in all of this, and we'll see that, because she's about to play the role of matchmaker in a very beautiful way. And she's got a lot of wisdom in that as well. So she told her mother-in-law, with whom she had worked, and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Yeah, Boaz, the guy whose field I happened to walk into and glean. Naomi said to her, "Blessed be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "This man is a relative of ours, one of our near kinsmen." All of this happened, the blessing and the person's field in whom she gleaned, without Ruth even knowing. Naomi catches on right away. "I know Boaz. He's a family member." And we'll see that he has a special role in this, because he's got an opportunity to bring these two ladies out from their poverty and destitution. And Naomi then is encouraged by this. What a blessing. continue on. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, "He said to me, 'You shall stay close with my young man until they have finished all my harvest.'" Yeah, I don't know if this is an important detail, Naomi, but he asked me to come back. I love this because it's so beautiful. Ruth is so innocent, perhaps a little naive, but Naomi knows exactly what's going on. She sees through this undercurrent. So she tells Naomi this. And Naomi said to her, Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young men and that people do not meet you in other fields." She said, don't let anybody see you in anybody else's field. Go only to Boaz. She's beginning to instruct Ruth out of her wisdom. And so it says in verse 23, she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. So we have this playing out, Naomi actually giving thanks to God in verse 20, and Boaz ends up being this near kinsman, which will play a vital role in the story in chapters 3 and 4. And the chapter ends with Naomi confirming to Ruth what she should do with Boaz. Stay close to him. Don't leave his side. And she's beginning to take on that matchmaker role. And I can see that playing out. I don't relate to that, but I can think of my wife, Tiffany. And maybe it's a thing that most of the ladies can relate to. This desire to see couples get together. Perhaps. I know my wife is always asking her brothers, "Have you seen anyone? Is anybody like? What about her? What about this one?" And Naomi takes that role, desiring to see Ruth and Boaz come together. And God is indeed working this out. We see his hand throughout all of this. But notice the change in Naomi. She was so distraught at the end of chapter 1. She wanted people to call her bitter. She went from being incredibly discouraged, and now things are looking up. She has a glimmer of hope, and she becomes overjoyed, excited at the prospect of this near kinsman and a blessing from God. The same way we could have that pendulum swing, go from deep discouragement and stress. And when God brings us out, we become overjoyed. That's what happens. And hopefully we can think about that, see that light at the end of the tunnel. So in closing, as we finish up here, we get also insight into the timing. We saw chapter 1 ended because it was right around the time of Passover. And we'll see she's going to continue with the Boaz to glean in verse 23 to the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. Now the barley harvest would continue until the wheat harvest would be later, but the wheat harvest would occur right around Pentecost. And we see that the wheat then would be used to make the loaves required for the Pentecost offerings. But we're counting towards Pentecost. Now we're at week 7 here. And we see the events really are framed around the festivals. Passover, and we'll see chapters 3 and 4 really occur around Pentecost time. So that takes us to the end of chapter 2. Brethren, I hope we have gleaned some encouragement from this book so far. It's a beautiful book, lots of insight into the culture and history of that time, and tremendous lessons for us today. We can draw spiritual parallels throughout this book, and there is impact in our lives and lessons we can draw. And so God willing, as we continue on over the next couple weeks, we'll be able to finish the book and learn even more lessons. So I wish everyone a profitable Sabbath and look forward to fellowshipping after services.